Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, from 1789 to 1989, by Michael Beschloss. Michael Beschloss has brought us an inspiring saga about crucial times in American history when a courageous president dramatically changed the future of the United States. You'll be in the room with a private George Washington, braving threats of impeachment and assassination to make peace with England, John Adams incurring his party's unrelenting hatred by refusing to fight France and warning his enemies, stating, "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war," Andrew Jackson in a death struggle against the corrupt Bank of the United States, Abraham Lincoln risking his presidency to insist that slaves be freed. Beschloss also shows us Theodore Roosevelt taunting J.P. Morgan and the Wall Street leaders who dominated his party, Franklin Roosevelt defying the isolationists and maybe the law to stop Adolf Hitler, Harry Truman risking a walkout by top officials to recognize a Jewish state, John Kennedy, the belated champion of civil rights, complaining that he has cost himself a second term, and finally, 200 years after George Washington, Ronald Reagan, irking some of his oldest backers to seek an end to the Cold War. We continue to read from Chapter 2, Kick This Treaty to Hell, in the story about George Washington in the summer of 1795, trying to decide whether to back John Jay's treaty with Britain to bring peace and resolve issues between the two countries. Soon the fracas over John Jay's treaty thundered into George Washington's Mount Vernon paradise, where he retreated there from Philadelphia. Retiring to his study, George Washington donned spectacles and read the favored reports from Philadelphia. He wrote, "The cry against the treaty is like that against a mad dog. People were running it down with the most abominable misrepresentations, and working like bees to distill their poison, fighting for victory more than truth." Washington found a letter from New Jersey too rude to merit a reply. Of one letter from Petersburg, Virginia, Washington wrote, "Tenor indecent, no answer returned." With still another, Washington wrote that a Solomon was not necessary to understand the letter's author's malign intentions. Writing to those he deemed worthy of response, George Washington asked for faith in his personal character, stating, "In every act of my administration, I have sought the happiness of my fellow citizens by ignoring personal, local, and partial consideration in favor of the permanent interests of our country and the dictates of my conscience." The president had yet to make up his mind about John Jay's treaty with Britain. He wrote Secretary of State Randolph that his current feeling was still what it was, namely, not favorable to it. But Washington went on. If Britain canceled its provision order and the obnoxious Article 12, it was probably better to ratify it than to suffer matters to remain as they are, unsettled. After a week at Mount Vernon, George Washington was so agitated by the political storm beyond his gates that he decided to return to Philadelphia, the capital of the country. With the country in violent paroxysm, he wrote that a crisis is approaching, threatening anarchy, if not arrested. With George Hammond sailing back to London in mid-August, the president felt he had to give the British his verdict on the treaty. His Secretary of State, Edmund Randolph, had offered to run down to Mount Vernon and provide his counsel to Washington. But with his sense of ritual and precedent, Washington felt that a matter of such vast magnitude should be resolved in Philadelphia with the advice of his full cabinet. The president informed Randolph that to leave home so soon would be inconvenient, but he would never suffer private convenience to interfere with his official duties. Bracing for the struggle ahead, Washington was preparing my mind for the obloquy which disappointment and malice are collecting to heap upon my character. Whatever the brickbats, Washington would not quit the ground he has taken. He saw, he wrote, but one straight course, and that is to seek truth and pursue it steadily. As the president's bags were packed, he received a baffling, ominous letter stating, "For your eyes alone," from his Secretary of War, Timothy Pickering. Pickering wrote, "Return with all convenient speed. On the subject of the treaty, I confess I feel extreme solicitude, and for a special reason which can be communicated to you only in person. Until then," he wrote, "I pray you to decide on no important political measure." Washington left Mount Vernon at the first moment the rains lifted, noting the suddenness of his departure. The roads had been miserably torn up by the storms, and the mills, damages, and bridges almost universally carried away. Reaching Philadelphia on Tuesday afternoon, August 11, 1795, Washington invited Secretary of State Randolph to his residence for dinner. He also summoned his Secretary of War, Pickering, who noted that Secretary Randolph looked cheerful dining with the president. Taking a glass of wine, George Washington rose from the table and winked at Secretary Pickering. Leaving Secretary Randolph behind, he led the Secretary of War into another chamber and shut the door. Referring to Pickering's strange message, he asked, "What is the cause of your writing me such a letter?" Pointing at the closed door, Pickering replied, "That man in the other room is a traitor." As Washington's Secretary of State, Edmund Randolph was no Thomas Jefferson. With Jefferson and Hamilton gone from Washington's cabinet, Washington was glad to be rid of their backbiting. But he missed what he called the first characters of his original cabinet, men of revolutionary stature. He also liked Randolph, but knew he was ultimately a trimmer and errand boy. Son of a royal attorney general of Virginia, scion of one of the Commonwealth's most respected dynasties, Randolph had used family connections, including Thomas Jefferson, his third cousin, to join George Washington's revolutionary staff, drafting letters and documents. After independence, Randolph took his father's old place as Virginia's attorney general, serving also as Washington's personal lawyer. By 1787, Randolph was governor of Virginia. When the Constitutional Convention was called for Philadelphia, he helped persuade Washington to attend, stating, "The general, with his usual pointed modesty, conceded that his friends seemed to wish for my attendance." After the Constitutional Convention proposed the Constitution and it was finished, Randolph refused to sign it. But once he saw the wind blowing in its favor, he campaigned for its ratification among the states. In 1789, the newly elected Washington asked Randolph to be his attorney general. Other, more august figures were delighted to join the great man's cabinet, but the tone-deaf Randolph complained that the salary was too small and only accepted the offer after the president reminded him that being attorney general would confer preeminence on any lawyer. When Hamilton and Jefferson squared off during Washington's first term, Randolph pleased the president by trying to conciliate the two men. After Jefferson resigned as Secretary of State, he suggested Randolph as his temporary successor, warning that with his financial problems, Randolph was not independent enough to have the job for good. But Washington did not want to eject the last remaining non-Federalist in his cabinet. Half-heartedly, Washington made Randolph his Secretary of State. Now, as Randolph waited in the other room of Washington's house, Pickering told the president why he thought his Secretary of State, Randolph, was guilty of treason. 2 weeks earlier, Pickering explained, George Hammond had shown Wolcott a packet of dispatches from the French minister in Philadelphia, Joseph Fawcett, captured when a British battleship, the Jean Bart, was seized in the Atlantic. The Frenchman had hurled the pouch into the sea, but a British sailor had grabbed the pouch. Pickering told Washington the documents showed that Randolph had divulged state secrets to Fawcett and asked him for a bribe to tilt American foreign policy towards France. He said they also showed that Randolph had secretly helped to incite the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794, which was against a federal liquor tax in Pennsylvania, which President Washington had quashed with 15,000 troops. Half fluent in French, Secretary War Pickering had scrawled out a rough English translation of Fawcett's messages, which he now handed to President Washington. Washington gave Pickering no hint of his reaction to the astonishing charge. Solemnly, Washington said, "Let us return to the other room to prevent any suspicion of the cause of our withdrawing by Randolph." Late that night, after Randolph and Pickering were gone, Washington was alone in his darkened mansion, except for the servants. Staggered by Pickering's revelations about Randolph, he had to decide by himself whether his top appointee was a new Benedict Arnold. Like Randolph, Benedict Arnold had been an ambitious young man with financial problems whom Washington had promoted during the war. As Philadelphia's wartime military governor, Arnold had resided in the very house before taking the secret British bribes that led to his treason against the Patriot cause. In the fall of 1780, after Benedict Arnold disappeared from his Hudson River headquarters at West Point, it was Alexander Hamilton who handed the incriminating dispatches to the president. "Benedict Arnold had betrayed us," replied the trembling Washington, blinking back tears back then during the war. "Whom can we trust now?" Tonight, at the president's house, Washington was determined to keep his quandary secret from Randolph. He did not call for expert advice or even for a better translation of Fawcett's dispatches. Instead, he was one man deliberating alone. In the absence of some magic document that would clear Randolph, Washington had to assess the damage of throwing him into a long public trial. Even if Randolph were found innocent of treason, many Americans and Europeans would suspect that Washington's chief diplomat had sold himself to a foreign power, France. For all Washington's pretensions about Republican virtue, the U.S. government would have revealed itself as no cleaner than the old world regimes. Already rocked by the national commotion over John Jay's treaty, Washington knew his administration might not survive such a scandal. Two centuries later, it is still impossible to establish whether Randolph was guilty. Like many diplomats, Fawcett may have exaggerated for the Home Office his craftiness in squeezing secrets out of the Secretary of State. While talking to Fawcett, trying to build a relationship, the clumsy Randolph may have also exaggerated his eagerness to help France. Missing from the French documents was dispatch number 6, which supposedly proved that Randolph had sold himself for cash. Washington knew that the British had the motive to fabricate a case against Randolph, who did not share the Federalist Anglophobia, and was advising the president to go slow on John Jay's. But Washington also realized that Randolph had ample motive to solicit a bribe. Feeling more cash poor than ever, the man had recently complained he could no longer entertain or use his carriage. The president darkly noted how Randolph had been dragging his heels on John Jay's treaty with Britain. The Secretary of State's insistence that the treaty be renegotiated would mean no deal with the British for at least a year, which would delight the French and the Jeffersonians who supported France. Before the morning light shone into Washington's upstairs bedroom, he made two important decisions. First, he would sign John Jay's treaty immediately. If the Randolph scandal was about to explode, he did not want to leave the treaty hanging, but he would insist that the British drop the despicable Article 12 of the proposed treaty. Second, Washington would fire Edmund Randolph, but not yet. If provoked, the Secretary of State would be in a position to scuttle Jay's treaty. Better to keep Randolph ignorant of the president's suspicions against him. Only after Randolph sent the executed treaty to London would Washington pounce. Chapter 3, The Damnedest Liar, and the continuation over the controversy about the proposed John Jay Treaty with Britain. On Wednesday morning, August 12, 1795, exhausted from lack of sleep, George Washington called in his cabinet secretaries and asked their formal advice on Jay's treaty. Backed by Wolcott and Attorney General William Bradford, Secretary of War Pickering advised Washington to ignore the detestable and nefarious protests and sign it. But Randolph, his Secretary of State, told the president he must not sign until the British canceled their provision order. Combining with Britain to starve the French might risk war. Washington overruled Randolph. "I will ratify the treaty." Randolph reacted with unutterable astonishment. During the next 5 days, using his considerable dramatic ability, Washington gave Secretary of State Randolph no hint anything was amiss. While quietly scrutinizing the Secretary of State for signs of guilt, Washington twice had Randolph to dinner and even ignored protocol. A president should call on no one, to take some papers over to Randolph's house. On Tuesday, August 18, 1795, Washington put his elegant signature on John Jay's treaty and had Randolph send it to British Minister Hammond. The next morning, he summoned Randolph to the president's house. Strolling to his meeting with Washington, Randolph was stopped by one of the general's stewards, who asked him not to arrive for 90 minutes. When Randolph was finally admitted to Washington's presence, he was startled to find him talking gravely with Wolcott and Pickering. The president gave him one of Fauchette's dispatches. "Make such explanations as you choose." Schooled in French, Randolph studied the document while the others watched. As Pickering later recalled, "The president desired us to watch Randolph's countenance and fixed his own eye on him." Pickering had never seen Washington's eye look so animated. After more than half an hour, Randolph denied saying anything improper to Fauchette or taking any money from him as a bribe. If allowed to examine the dispatch further, he could, quote, "throw my ideas on paper." "Very well," said Washington, "retain it." He asked Randolph to leave the room. Wolcott and Pickering told Washington Randolph had looked embarrassed, but showed no sign of guilt in reading the dispatch. When Randolph rejoined them, having absorbed the full impact of his plight, Randolph shrieked, "I could not continue in the office 1 second after such treatment." He ran down the stairs and out of the presidential mansion. With Randolph lashing out, Washington knew he was in danger of a messy public scandal. He looked shocked and apprehensive. The next day, Randolph sent Washington a scorching resignation, stating, "Your confidence in me, sir, has been unlimited. My sensations, then, cannot be concealed when I find that confidence so immediately withdrawn, without a word or distant hint being previously dropped to me." Randolph warned that he would not stop trying to clear his name, stating, "No, sir, far from it." He wanted Fauchette to show him Dispatch 6 and other papers. "Until then, the president," he said, "as one piece of justice due me, must keep his accusations in secrecy." Anxious to contain the scandal, Washington was happy to oblige Randolph's request. Writing a fellow Jeffersonian, James Madison, Randolph compared the president to a Roman tyrant, stating, "I feel happy at my emancipation from attachment to a man who has practiced on me the profound hypocrisy of a Tiberius and the injustice of an assassin." The next scene was picturesque. Fauchette had gone to Newport, Rhode Island, where the French frigate Medusa was ready to take him home to France. But the Medusa was trapped in Newport Harbor by the British cruiser Africa, whose crew hoped to kidnap Fauchette, or at least steal a few seamen from nearby U.S. ships. When the breathless Randolph caught up with Fauchette in Newport, the French minister pledged to clear Randolph's name in writing. But the storms forced the British ship Africa out to sea, and the French ship Medusa escaped with Fauchette aboard. By the time Randolph came to Fauchette's lodgings to pick up the promise statement, the Frenchman had already sailed away. Frantically, Randolph hired a boat, but could not catch up with the Medusa. Instead, he announced an appeal to the people of the United States, which would reveal why he had resigned as Secretary of State. Randolph asked Washington by letter for a copy of his written advice not to sign Jay's treaty until the British canceled their provision order. To show he had nothing to hide, Washington replied that Randolph could, quote, publish without reserve any and every private and confidential letter I ever wrote you, nay more, every word I have ever uttered in your presence, close quote. He was sure Americans would appreciate my motives, even if they condemned giving Randolph such unlimited license. Eager to trap the president into confessing that he had dirty secrets, Randolph replied that he wouldn't exhibit to public view all and everything which is known to me. Furious at Randolph's insinuation, Washington wrote a rough draft of a scouting reply, saying that he couldn't see what relation there is between the treaty with Great Britain and the intercepted letter of Mr. Fauchet of France. On second thought, the president decided that Randolph's letter was too full of innuendos to deserve any reply. From that day forward, Washington never communicated with Edmund Randolph again. By Christmas 1795, Randolph tried to have the last word with a 103-page pamphlet which he called Vindication. In it, he admitted asking Joseph Fauchet for money, but dubiously claimed that his purpose was to help flour merchants holding evidence that Great Britain had secretly instigated the Whiskey Rebellion. Foreshadowing some aides fired by later presidents, Randolph tried to destroy his old boss. He wrote that beneath Washington's exterior of cool and slow deliberation was a small mind that rapidly catches a prejudice and with difficulty abandons it. Randolph claimed that Washington had signed John Jay's treaty so abruptly because he was growing senile and overambitious to give selfish advantage to the Federalists. Disgusted, Vice President John Adams found Randolph's broadside a piece of revenge against the president, but for what injury or offense, I cannot discover. His logic is better for a comedian than a statesman. Washington was incensed by Randolph's charge that, quote, my final decision on Jay's treaty was a result of party advice. For the president, being called partisan was almost the worst insult to him. Thumping a table, Washington cried, according to one witness, that Randolph, by the external God, was the damnedest liar on the face of the earth. Washington bemoaned his stupidity in appointing Randolph, and now he has written and published this. Bursting with epithets, he hurled his copy of Randolph's Vindication at the floor. The obtuse Randolph had hoped his pamphlet Vindication might restore his political stardom. He did not understand that, however much Americans might oppose Jay's treaty with Britain, you could not expect to battle the hero of the Revolution over personal honor and expect to win. Gleefully, Wolcott plunged a knife into Randolph's back, announcing that the former Secretary of State had taken official money. Barred from evidence that might have cleared him, Randolph had to pay the government $50,000, or about $1 million today. Forced to borrow the money from a relative, Randolph and his wife were reduced to what they considered semi-poverty. When America's Secretary of State died in 1813, Randolph was so forgotten that his hometown, Richmond, Virginia's paper, reported his death in only four sentences. Back at Mount Vernon in the fall of 1795, Washington consoled himself that the great body of yeomanry had no real opinion about Jay's treaty. With the abominable misrepresentations being published, who should wonder that uninformed minds thought it diabolical? The voice of malignancy was trying to wound my character and deceive the people. But one of Jefferson's Virginia Republicans wrote a friend that Washington had been unmasked as the head of a British faction, and gratitude no longer binds the public mind. The New York Daily Gazette published the old, forged British claims that General Washington had secretly conspired with King George. The forgeries used information about the general's private life that Washington suspected had been provided by the Anglo-Servile father of Edmund Randolph. The president privately resolved to let his calumniators proceed without taking notice of their invectives himself. Next came an ugly display of what Washington called Britain's dominating spirit. A British consul in America ordered some British sailors on shore leave hunted down like criminals. Outraged by Britain's contempt for U.S. law, the president threatened military retaliation. He warned John Jay that such British high-handedness would sour the minds of those who are friends to peace, order, and friendship. In December 1795, Washington arrived at Congress Hall to deliver the annual report required by the Constitution. Thanks to the battle over Jay's treaty, it was the first time the president addressed the House and Senate without a full assurance of meeting a welcome. He insisted that Jay's pact would keep external discord from disrupting our tranquility. Then, how precious a foundation will have been laid for accelerating, maturing, and establishing the prosperity of our country. As Washington said, this was a fervent and favorite wish of his heart. Caught off guard by the commotion over Jay's treaty, powerful federal tycoons rolled into gear. New York firms stopped issuing ship insurance until the treaty was enacted, making the Atlantic safer. Maryland Federalists drew up petitions crying, "It's time for Baltimore to save the Republic." In Philadelphia, debtors were pressured by the banks to support the treaty. James Madison complained that it was like a highwayman with a pistol demanding the purse. Taking his nom de plume from the Roman truth-teller Camillus, Alexander Hamilton wrote passionate essays against the Republican War Party. "Should America attempt to fight England now," he said, "our trade, navigation, and mercantile capital would be essentially destroyed." Knowing the identity of the hidden writer, Washington wrote Hamilton of his pleasure in reading the arguments on the signature of Camus. Thomas Jefferson lamented that Hamilton's intellectual fireworks were so much brighter than the middling performances of his own Republicans. Reading about the political controversy between the Federalists and the Republicans over the proposed John Jay Treaty will continue. Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders, and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989. And this has been American History. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.